Also going to debut a new theme song. Me and Del Oliver are going to take you from modest to another. It's an old song I wrote. We're going to debut it at BFG. Very excited about that.
You're my prison bitch, my prison bitch. You're not like other men. I'm glad we share a prison cell when lights go out at 10. I can't escape the way I feel, now that would be a crime. As long as I am doing you, I don't mind doing time. Cause you're my prison bitch, my prison bitch. And I have no regrets. I got you for a candy bar and a pack of cigarettes.
There you have it. There's a Sound Off exclusive for you. Jeff Hardy's new theme music that he will be debuting at Bound for Glory on 10-10-10. Right here on the Sound Off. You heard it here first. And I will say this much. Depending on how those charges shake out against him, he may be singing that song before long. So there you go. This is episode 127, a special edition of the Sound Off here on SEScoops.com. It is Saturday, September 25th, 2010. I am the Solo Monster, and thank you, as always, for downloading the podcast. Of course, those of you who listened in last week know that I am going to be offering a bit of a review on different areas of World Wrestling Entertainment and its business, and we're going to get to that in just a little bit. Got a couple of news items to get to first, as always. First off, pay-per-view last weekend, WWE Night of Champions. Of course, my predictions were shaky at best, as I knew they would be. The two big things, I guess, number one in my book anyway, Kane with a clean win over The Undertaker. And I talked about it on the show last week that aside from one Raw match, I think back in 1998, I could not think of a match that Kane got a clean pinfall win over The Undertaker. And thankfully, we can now say that Night of Champions 2010, Kane indeed got a clean pinfall win over The Undertaker. So I was happy to see that. And Randy Orton wins the, I guess it's his sixth WWE championship, his seventh overall world championship, winning the six-pack challenge, defeating Sheamus. So Randy Orton is the new WWE champion. I would not have put the belt on him just yet, but what do I know? Chris Jericho eliminated from the match in short order, and of course, showing up on Raw the next night, and this coming Monday night, he actually has a match with Randy Orton, and I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but I'm sure many of you know about it by now. If you don't want to hear any spoilers for Raw this Monday, just fast forward about 30 seconds here, but Chris Jericho will be punted in the head and taken out on a gurney this coming Monday night. That will be his send-off from World Wrestling Entertainment, so nobody seems to know if he's signed a new contract yet, if he will, if he already has, but they're keeping it under wraps. We knew he'd have some time off anyway, and I know he has some European dates coming up next month to perform overseas with Fozzy. And then, of course, Jericho has his new book coming out in February. So, from the looks of it, Jericho, if I had to take a guess, is going to be back in WWE. I just don't ever see him going to TNA. And maybe should not look for Jericho until the new year. So that's a shame, but that's the story right now on Chris Jericho. So there you go. Caught SmackDown last night in the awesome return of Paul Bearer to WWE. Really, really cool stuff. Paul Bearer, of course, being wheeled down to the ring in a casket. Kane opens up the lid. Paul Bearer is laying in there. He pops out with the urn. Lights go out. Come back on. Who's in the ring but The Undertaker? Paul Bearer in the ring with him. Beats the crap out of Kane. Undertaker kneeling before Paul Bearer, recapturing the power of the urn. Look, if they're going to take this storyline in a superhuman direction, you may as well go all the way with it. And I can't think of a better way to cap this thing off than by having Paul Bearer, the longtime manager of The Undertaker, and don't forget, Kane's daddy, having him back in the storyline. Of course, it's been over 6 years since Paul Bearer took a cement nap, thanks to The Undertaker. And the, God, that was the Great American Bash pay-per-view back in 04, one of the worst pay-per-views in WWE history. And glad to see Paul Bearer back. You know, it's good to see any manager used in WWE, and I'm going to talk about managers a little bit later on. So I'm all for it, and I'm a little more interested now to see where the storyline goes. You know, again, this stuff is not doing any big business. It's not popping any big buy rates or ratings on SmackDown. But as far as the Undertaker and Kane storyline, and look, if you're going to go back in time and, you know, rekindle a rivalry that's 13 years or so in the making, you got to bring Paul Bearer back into it somehow. And it wouldn't shock me at all to see Bearer do a turn at some point, even though we've seen it before. I'm curious, though, more so now than I was before, to see where this thing goes. So really, really cool moment to end SmackDown last night. In my opinion, probably the best moment of the week on WWE TV. And it also makes for a nice hook as far as SmackDown next week, because, of course, last night was the final My Network edition of SmackDown. The show will begin airing live. Well, it'll be live for 1 week only, but it'll be live on Sci-Fi Channel next week, and perhaps we will get a Paul Bearer promo. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Some bad news for SmackDown. Christian apparently tore his pec. I don't know when exactly he suffered that injury, but he was written out in an injury angle storyline on SmackDown this week with Alberto Del Rio, and Christian not expected back for about 6 months or so. So that is a huge blow to the SmackDown brand. Not that Christian was involved in any main event programs, but Christian has been one of the, if not the big workhorse on that show for many, many months now. And obviously whatever program he had with Del Rio now is cut short. So it's just a shitty situation all around, and hopefully Christian will get better and he'll get back real soon. That was a big blow to the SmackDown brand. The big news earlier in the week, Mickie James apparently signing with TNA. It was believed that she was either on the verge of signing or had already signed a contract with Total Nonstop Action. I believe she already has. And would not shock me to see her make her debut as early as the Live Impact on October 7th. So, look, my philosophy here is this. I've talked before about how TNA is kind of looked at as the place where all the WWE rejects go. And in many cases, it's true. Not to take away the talent from people like Brian Kendrick, you know, and people like that. But when you take a lot of those lower-level guys from WWE and immediately sign them up to a TNA deal, it just makes you look low rent. This is one of those cases where I don't fault TNA for this at all, and in fact, I think it's a really good pickup for TNA. You know, Mickie James had her detractors backstage in WWE, and, you know, she was being late to shows and stuff, and that was kind of where she sealed her fate, so it was more of a disciplinary thing, but I still think Mickie James being cut loose by WWE was the wrong move. You know, you could have suspended her, you could have talked to her about it. She was probably the best that you had in that women's division, and letting her go was a bad thing. And I don't blame TNA at all in this case. They scooped up a pretty good talent. Lord knows their Knockouts division needs all the help it can get. And I think Mickie James will be nothing but a positive for it. So thumbs up for TNA, and hopefully Mickie, we'll see. I think her real name is Mickie LeRae James. I know when she was in TNA many, many years ago, before she came to WWE, she went by the name Alexis LeRae. And I believe LeRae is her real middle name, but Mickie James, I think, is her actual name. So we'll see what they call her. She should be able to go by the same name, but with these things, you just never know. And a bit of sad news, yet another wrestler death, although this one wasn't completely unexpected, but nonetheless, I think we've had enough wrestling deaths in 2010. Apparently the Grim Reaper didn't think so, and so we have one more to talk about here. Jorge Gonzalez, better known in his WWE heyday as the Giant Gonzalez, or El Gigante, when he was in WCW in the early 90s, who was legitimately the tallest wrestler in the history of the business at a legit 7 feet 7 inches tall, well over 400 pounds. Jim Ross was actually one of the people who discovered him. He used to play basketball. And, you know, they thought that he had a lot of potential as a monster figure in the wrestling business. So they brought him into WCW, and he had nothing but horrible matches. He just never picked up on the art of wrestling, for lack of a better term. So, of course, WWF had to snatch him up and made his debut. It was a memorable debut, back when debuts actually meant something. It was the 1993 Royal Rumble. I remember watching it at home on pay-per-view. And the Undertaker was cleaning house in the Rumble match. And all of a sudden, Harvey Whippleman leads this just gargantuan-looking guy in this ridiculous furry outfit, which had painted-on abs, and it was a ridiculous costume. But the guy was just awe-inspiring to look at. He was truly a giant. And he was not in the Rumble, but Whippleman leads him down. Now, remember, Undertaker had vanquished Kamala a couple of months earlier, who was managed by Harvey Whippleman. So this was Whippleman's revenge. And the sight of Gonzalez going face-to-face with Undertaker, it wasn't even face-to-face, it was more like face-to-chest. Seeing the Undertaker dwarfed by somebody else back then was truly a sight to see. And, of course, he got pummeled down and eliminated by Gonzalez. It led to a WrestleMania match. That was a WrestleMania 9 at Caesar's Palace, a pretty bad match. And their return match at SummerSlam really wasn't much better. That was when Gonzalez lost and chokeslammed Harvey Whippleman at the end of the match and basically turned babyface at that point. He only made a couple of more appearances on TV after that, and then he was gone. And I think that was it for him in the wrestling business. I remember he was on an episode of Baywatch back when that show was big, playing a sympathetic babyface, ironically enough. And you didn't really hear much about him after that. You know, being that big, you knew that he was going to have health problems down the road, and he did. He was a native of Argentina. I believe he moved back there, and he's been there ever since. And I believe what he died from was actually complications from diabetes. So, just a sad story. It's kind of ironic because I had meant to mention this on a recent Sound Off. I don't know why I didn't. I found a link. This was actually maybe 2 weeks ago, to a YouTube video. I don't know why. I had been wondering, whatever happened to Giant Gonzalez? It's just eerie. I was thinking about this a couple of weeks ago. And I found a video on YouTube that some guy filmed. It was some American guy who went down to Argentina to find Giant Gonzalez. And the video was set to this weird, wacky, funny music. And they actually found him. Because I was curious. I had heard that he was wheelchair-bound, which he may well have been. But in this video, the guy finds Giant Gonzalez, I guess at his home or whatever, sitting outside on the porch. Not in a wheelchair, just seemingly sitting in a chair. And, you know, Gonzalez gets up, and he's kind of, I don't know, they're just kind of being stupid and raising their hands and shouting and hollering. And it's just meant, I guess, in good fun. Kind of a happy video. If you notice, though, if you happen to find the video on YouTube, Gonzalez is leaning up against the wall. I didn't notice it at first until I watched it a second time. He was never standing upright on his own. He was always holding on to or leaning against the wall, I guess, because he just wasn't able to stand up on his own anymore. And he was sweating. I mean, he had sweat stains coming through his shirt like you wouldn't believe. But overall, he looked to be in pretty good spirits, and he didn't look awful. And, I mean, according to the video, it looks like it was recorded back in 2007. So, you know, it was a fairly recent video, so I took that to mean that the guy must be doing well enough. And then 2 weeks later, I find out he died. So that was a little eerie. But just, you know, sad story. You know, people that large, unfortunately, don't live that long. And what can I say? He had horrible matches. I'm not going to, you know, just because he died, I'm not just going to say, well, you know, he was an okay wrestler. No, you know, he seems like he was a really nice man. Probably a pretty stand-up guy, but just a shitty, shitty wrestler. I cannot remember a single match of his that was actually average, let alone good. And it's not necessarily his fault. You know, he got thrust into the business, and people saw his size, and they figured, well, he can be a big money draw. And he certainly could have been. With that size. Like I said, he was legit the tallest guy ever in the business, but he just never picked up on it, and unfortunately, we got a lot of bad matches that we had to sit through. So sorry to hear about his death, and I sound like a broken record here, but again, hopefully this will be the last wrestler death that we have to hear about in 2010. Something tells me probably not going to be, but hopefully it is. Now, just a couple of quick thoughts here before I get into my WWE review on Matt Hardy. Well, I said my piece last week. I said I didn't want to talk about Matt Hardy anymore, but how could I not? Since last week's podcast, he's posted two or three more YouTube videos. He actually posted a video several days ago that painted him in a semi-coherent light. It was him sitting in front of a drum set, I guess, in his basement, and it was like an eight-minute video, and he was speaking very seriously and honestly, not in character. And again, going on and on and on about the same stuff, but he at least seemed somewhat sane. And not a day or two later, he posts another YouTube video late at night, apparently, and he's in a ring that he has set up, and he's in a hoodie, and he's hitting the ropes back and forth. And somebody is filming this with a flip camera, and then he comes over to the camera, and he's in a very bizarre state of mind, as he always seems to be, eating a bag of grapes, which apparently he is very fond of. Okay. It all went downhill from there. I didn't even watch the whole video because, again, it was the usual Matt Hardy bullshit. The last video I saw, which I think he posted earlier today or yesterday, is apparently now he's claiming, and this has to be part of some sort of storyline. Now, what this would be a storyline for, I don't know. That's why this is so stupid to me, because who are you really catering to? What is this a storyline for, exactly? You know what I mean? It doesn't really make any sense. It's not going to make any money. But apparently Matt now is claiming that he was told by a doctor, perhaps, that he is suffering from some sort of split personality condition called DID, whatever. You know, one personality is Matt, and then the alternate personality is Matthew, who has no inhibitions and does what he wants when he wants to, blah, 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 blah. Who could possibly care about Matt Hardy at this point? Any value he may have, by the way, even as far as TNA is concerned, is devalued every single day. Maybe it's his own personal storyline heading into TNA because he knows he's inevitably going to end up there. Like I said, if I was Vince McMahon, it probably wouldn't be wise to keep this guy under contract in case he does something wacky. But I'd probably just keep him under contract until the end of his deal, just to fuck with him, just so he can't go anywhere else and he's pretty much just stuck, and just let him sit at home and make videos all day. Again, I don't really care enough to comment beyond that. I've gotten so many. I mean, if you go on my Facebook page, I've got so many people posting the Matt Hardy videos and asking me for my opinions, and I get emails about it. So, you know, I have to address it. I can't just ignore it. And it's kind of funny, but it's also kind of sad. And I'm not going to spend 15 minutes of my time analyzing these Matt Hardy videos, because to me, Matt Hardy is irrelevant. He's been irrelevant for years. He will continue to be irrelevant. And nothing will change that. He could eat all the grapes he wants to. To me, it's nothing but sour grapes. And I wish Matt Hardy nothing but the best, and hope to God that people who live in the neighborhood that he lives in, and I think he might actually live in like a trailer park or something. Actually, I take that back. I think Jeff Hardy used to live in a trailer. Matt, I think, actually has a nice home in North Carolina. So, again, I reiterate, anybody who lives within, I'd say, a 3-mile radius of Matt Hardy's home, just do me a favor and just put an extra padlock on your door when you go to bed at night. Maybe get a guard dog. I wouldn't trust this guy. Just make sure you stay safe, and hopefully Matt will get the help he needs for his split personality. I wonder if the other personality is the fat one and he's the thin one. Nah, anyway. So let's move on here to a special report, if you will. As I said earlier, this is a special edition of the Sound Off. Now that I got the news out of the way, I'm going to dedicate the rest of this show to a review of WWE's business in terms of things that I would change, things that I would keep the same, things that are ideas that I would bring back. Now, let me set the situation up for you here, because, like I said before, I'm all about realism here on the Sound Off. Let's just say, hypothetically speaking, that tomorrow, Vince McMahon is exiting Titan Tower, and Matt Hardy has driven up from North Carolina in a drunken rage and mows down Vince McMahon in a pool of blood. So Vince McMahon is dead. Now, according to Vince McMahon's will, much to everyone's shock and dismay, he does not leave control of World Wrestling Entertainment to his daughter, to his son-in-law, Triple H, or even his son, Shane. Of course, he's not going to leave it to his wife, because his wife is too busy running for Senate. So, shockingly enough, in his will, it states that Vince McMahon leaves all power and control over World Wrestling Entertainment to the Solo Monster. And why wouldn't he? Me and him go way back. So now, I have power and control as chairman of the board of World Wrestling Entertainment. What would I do to make the company better? Now, let me preface this by saying, WWE, I don't cry for the executives at World Wrestling Entertainment. WWE as a company is a powerhouse. It is a juggernaut. If you compare WWE of 2010 to the WWE of 1996, which was a company quite literally on the brink of bankruptcy, even though creatively speaking, you know, I may have actually enjoyed the product more back then, the company, fact is, was not doing too well, especially once it started getting its ass handed to it each week by WCW, because back then it was all about ratings, it was all about us versus them, and fact is, WWE was losing badly to WCW. They were hemorrhaging talent, being stolen away by WCW and Ted Turner's big bucks, and it was not good times for the World Wrestling Federation. Fast forward to 2010, as awful as the product may be, the fact is, their business is doing phenomenally well, and they still turn a profit every year. They've got so many different revenue streams where if one thing, like pay-per-view, for example, is not doing too well, they could probably make up for it in terms of merchandising and DVD sales and ticket sales. And they have so many different revenue streams, their video on demand service, and they're talking about starting up their own TV network by the end of next year. They have WWE Studios, which actually does turn a profit, even though most of their movies suck pretty badly. The fact is, the only movie that they've actually lost money on so far is Steve Austin's The Condemned. And so far, Legendary, although they're pretty confident that John Cena's new movie will make the money for the budget back in DVD sales. Only time will tell on that one. But nonetheless, WWE is doing very well. I don't want this to sound as though, well, you know, WWE is on the brink of going out of business. It ain't going to happen anytime. It ain't going to happen in this decade, let's put it that way. However, you and I both know that there are a lot of different areas in WWE that are neglected or that are lacking, and I'm not just talking about creative. Ways that they can improve their company, things of that nature. So I've broken it up into a couple of different categories, and again, it's really easy for me to sit here and say what I would do. I understand that not everything here is necessarily realistic, but there are a lot of ideas here that are very realistic and are very doable. And I said it last week, if they would just take three of these ideas, depending on what they are, it could really make a big deal as far as their business or the overall enjoyment of their product is concerned. Even casual fans, and I'm not just talking about hardcore fans like myself, but even casual fans, I think, would appreciate some of these little subtle changes. So, the first thing I want to look at here is the roster. Now, WWE has a great deal of talent on their roster right now, both Raw and SmackDown. I won't say that it's the strongest roster they've ever had, because it's not. But they've got a great deal of talent. However, I would say that a company, for example, like TNA has every bit as much talent as WWE does on their roster, and maybe even more. The thing about TNA, of course, is that the people who run that company don't know what the hell they're doing. So the talent suffers and the fans suffer. But that does not mean that TNA does not have a lot of talent. Now, TNA, however, and I said earlier, WWE is not exactly on the brink of bankruptcy. TNA ain't doing too well these days. They are losing money. They're trying to cut costs wherever possible. I'm not going to say TNA is going to be out of business in a year, but it's a hell of a lot more realistic to think that there won't be a TNA come 2012 than there won't be a WWE. So let us just envision for a second a situation where TNA is no more, where TNA is on its last legs, and I, as chairman of the board and the head, the leader of World Wrestling Entertainment, is looking to raid talent away from the TNA roster. These people are going to be unemployed any day now. So if I could pluck certain talents off the TNA roster, who would I take? Now, first of all, I wouldn't take everybody in the company because it's just not feasible to do so. However, there are certain people from TNA that I would take. And again, this comes from the questions that I always get. If you could take people from TNA, who would you take? And if you could take people from Ring of Honor, who would you take? And I'm going to tell you exactly who I would take. I'll start with Ring of Honor since I brought that up. Now, WWE already has Tyler Black under contract. Tyler Black, for those of you who don't know, is the now former Ring of Honor champion. He did drop the belt recently. He signed his WWE developmental deal last month. He's actually down in Florida Championship Wrestling as we speak. He's a hell of a hand. He's a young guy. He's a good-looking guy. He's got the size. He's not a, you know, he's not like a giant or anything, but he's not a small guy. I could see him doing big things in WWE. And obviously they can too because they signed him. So they already have Tyler Black. He would have been on my original list, in addition to Tyler Black. One person who I think deserves a second chance, who was already signed to a contract, and they didn't really do much with him, unfortunately, is Colt Cabana. Colt Cabana, you might know him as Scotty Goldman when he was on SmackDown. And talk about a charismatic guy. Colt Cabana is full of charisma. And on top of that, even though he may not look physically, you know, chiseled like some of the guys in the WWE roster, he's a pretty damn good wrestler on top of it. He came up with a lot of these guys, like Punk and Joe and all these different guys. He did not get a fair shake his first time around. Now, when he was here the first time, I could not understand why they didn't do something with him and CM Punk. And I maintain that to this day. I would bring Colt Cabana to WWE, and I would most definitely put him together in some way with CM Punk, even if he was Punk's lackey. You know, now that the straight edge society is seemingly a thing of the past, why not bring in Cabana for some added comedy relief? Why not bring him in to second CM Punk, if you will? It just seems like a no-brainer to me. So Cabana is somebody that I would definitely bring over from Ring of Honor, without question. Now, two tag teams from Ring of Honor that I would be very interested in, because Lord knows WWE needs some help as far as bolstering their tag team division. And quite frankly, they've shied away from tag team wrestling in recent years. They've made it something that is virtually non-existent. And that's a shame. One of the things that I would do is I would want to reinvigorate tag team wrestling. And so, two teams from Ring of Honor that really interest me are the Briscoes, Jay and Mark, no relation to Gerald as far as I know, and the Kings of Wrestling, Chris Hero and Claudio Castagnoli. Now, Claudio is another guy who WWE signed to a contract, and there was some sort of visa issue that had to be worked out. So basically, they let him go, and they never bothered to bring him back. You know, and Claudio has only gotten better since the time WWE let him go. Why he has not been given another opportunity, I'll never know. It's a crime, quite frankly, that he hasn't. Him and Chris Hero are extremely entertaining, and they're also a pretty damn good tag team together. And Chris Hero is another guy who deserves a shot. So the Briscoes and the Kings of Wrestling, I would be more than happy to bring them aboard as part of my tag team division in WWE. Yeah, and while we're at it, two female performers that are currently, I believe, under contract to Ring of Honor are Daisy Hayes and Sarah Del Rey, who also wrestles for the Shimmer women's promotion. Ironically, Sarah Del Rey also has the Flight of the Valkyries theme music, which was the awesome theme music that Daniel Bryan debuted on Raw this past Monday night. I knew there was something I forgot to talk about. That was phenomenal, by the way. I loved that entire segment. To me, was a total win. It was also kind of funny, by the way. I know I'm deviating a little bit here, but if you watch that segment from Monday night when The Miz and Alex Riley were beating down Daniel Bryan, you'll notice that Alex Riley, on like two or three different occasions, he had Daniel Bryan hooked for Miz to beat him down. He let Daniel Bryan go, and The Miz was kind of getting pissed off. And he kept telling Alex Riley, pick him up, pick him up. So I thought that was kind of funny. But in any event, Daisy Hayes and Sarah Del Rey, two very, very talented female performers, that I think deserve a shot on the big stage. And the thing about Ring of Honor is that, you know, Ring of Honor owner Kari Silken has said before that he would not block any talent from Ring of Honor who was offered a deal by a TNA or a WWE. He would not deny his men and women the opportunity to make a better living for themselves, because obviously you're going to make a lot more money in WWE than you will in ROH. So he said before that he would not stand in the way of anybody who wanted to leave. Those are the people I would want, in addition to Tyler Black, who we already have, from Ring of Honor. Now, let's move on to TNA. Who would I take from TNA? Well, what might be more interesting is who I wouldn't take from TNA. But I could tell you that the people that I would want from TNA, it's very simple. Kurt Angle. Now, I know Kurt, the best thing that ever happened to Kurt Angle was going to TNA. Kurt Angle was on a bad road. Let's put it, you know, a road to a very bad place if he would have stayed in WWE. So if it's a matter of working out a part-time schedule or a special schedule with built-in time off for Kurt, I'm willing to do that because Kurt is that special of a talent. And quite frankly, he deserves to be back in WWE. He deserves to be back and have matches with guys like Randy Orton and you know, some of the younger talent coming up, even guys like Miz and Morrison and people like that. So I would most definitely want Kurt Angle on my roster. Jeff Hardy. Now, I know that Jeff Hardy still has charges pending against him, and quite frankly, I might want to wait to sign Jeff Hardy until those issues are resolved. But Jeff Hardy, there is no denying, was the biggest wrestling star of 2009 in the world. He was the most popular. He was the most searched on Google. He sold a shit ton of merchandise when he was in WWE before he left. Jeff Hardy is not getting any younger. So if you're going to capitalize on this guy and you're going to make money off Jeff Hardy, you got to bring him back now. So Jeff Hardy is somebody who, a hell of a lot more so than his brother these days, I would want on my roster. Jeff Hardy has proven in recent matches that he's had, including with Kurt Angle in TNA, that he could still pull out a great match every now and then if he's motivated enough to do so. He has not looked motivated to me in TNA until recently. I think he deserves another shot in WWE. The Pope, D'Angelo De Niro, who again was underutilized in WWE as Elijah Burke, went to TNA, came up with this Pope character, and it really took off. Now, from what I understand, there are some talents who are not big fans of the Pope. He tends to have a chip on his shoulder in real life, and he's not exactly the most well-liked person behind the scenes. Let me make one thing perfectly clear. First of all, there's no problem having an ego. Everybody in wrestling has an ego, and if they don't, they have to, because if you don't think enough of yourself and your own talents, then nobody else is going to. So I get that. But the thing is, one thing I won't stand for is people who are going to come in and be a cancer in the locker room. So I can tell you that if the Pope was going to be a problem, the Pope is a problem that I would get rid of very quickly. However, that being said, I'm willing to bring him on board because I think he's a talented guy who I could definitely see making money and having some great matches down the road. Abyss. Now, I'm not a big fan of the way that Abyss abuses his body, and I would certainly want to put some limits on that. You're not going to see Abyss in Monsters Ball barbed wire matches in WWE. However, the fact is, he is a monster, and I think there's a lot you can do with that character as a monster heel. So I would most definitely want Abyss on my roster. Samoa Joe. I think Samoa Joe, quite frankly, made a mistake going to TNA instead of WWE. Who knows if they would have used him properly. The fact is, if I were in charge of WWE, you can rest assured that a guy like Samoa Joe would be used properly. Samoa Joe is not meant to be a joke. He's not meant to walk around with a giant machete with shitty tattoos on his face. You know, Joe is actually a pretty personable guy. You know, he doesn't have to be a monster, a mute who never talks. He can talk. In fact, that's one of Joe's best qualities. He can really sell you on a match. He's very intense. He goes in there, he beats people up. That's what he does best. There's most definitely room for Samoa Joe on my roster, without question. Desmond Wolfe. He obviously has some issues. I don't know, you know, with his arms, with his head, and prior concussions. I think that, you know, certainly TNA right now is doing the right thing by keeping him out of action. If he can prove himself healthy enough, I think he would be a fine addition to the WWE roster. And we would definitely need to drop that shitty Desmond Wolfe name and get that Nigel McGuinness name back very quickly. Magnus, his tag partner of late, is another guy who I think, quite frankly, I think he's got a future ahead of him. He's a young guy. He's very young, actually. He's got a good look. He's improved in the ring in terms of his in-ring work. And the fact is, it always helps to have an international star on your roster. You know, that's why WWE has gone out of its way to bring in a lot of international guys. And not just Sheamus and Wade Barrett, but now you see Alberto Del Rio, appealing to the Mexican audience, or at least that's what they hope. It never hurts to have a little bit of international flavor on your roster. Magnus is somebody who I think deserves a shot. Jay Lethal, Amazing Red, two amazing, no pun intended, personalities that I would want on my roster. Doug Williams is another one as well, a great in-ring performer who does have some personality to him. Lance Storm, God bless him, I think he was a great wrestler, but Lance Storm is a great example of a guy who was terrific in the ring, but really didn't have a whole hell of a lot of charisma. Doug Williams is a great wrestler who I think does have charisma, and I think would be a fine addition to the roster as well. Tag teams. Goes without saying. Motor City Machine Guns, Beer Money, Generation Me, who, quite frankly, I think that's a shit name. I'd go back to the Young Bucks, but that's just me. Those three teams would be the first ones I would sign to a TNA deal. And once you do that, again, all of a sudden, that tag team division that WWE has, which looks like shit right now, all you have is the Hart Dynasty, who were made to look like jobbers last week on Raw by Michael Cole. You've got the Usos, who have completely had their legs cut out from underneath them. And you've got the makeshift tag team now of Drew McIntyre and Cody Rhodes. And that's it. Now, all of a sudden, you've added the Briscoes from Ring of Honor, the Kings of Wrestling, the Machine Guns, Beer Money, and Generation Me. And now you have a tag team division, quite frankly, that rivals any tag division, I think, in WWE history. The Beautiful People. Ah, yes, the Beautiful People. We all know that Velvet Sky and Lacey Von Erich, hot as they may be, could not wrestle to save their life. Angelina Love is not quite as bad. I won't go as far as to call her a good female wrestler. But she's certainly light years ahead of Velvet Sky and Lacey Von Erich. However, the fact is, the Beautiful People, they are very attractive, and they do have a lot of personality. And I think that I think I would want them under contract. I think there's a lot that you could do with them, and not necessarily wrestling in matches. I would probably want to keep them together as a unit. They would do some wrestling, but even as a valet or some other act on the roster, I think there's some usefulness there for them. So I would definitely want them under contract. And then I would round out my list with Jeremy Borash, Don West, and Taz. I think Jeremy Borash does a very good job for what he does, and I have some things in mind for him. Don West is awesome. Don West, I think, before they removed him as an announcer, was starting to come into his own. As a color announcer. However, where he has really proved his worth, which really shouldn't be a surprise to anybody because this is what he did for a living before he came into wrestling, is sales. He has single-handedly made TNA Shop, if that's what it's called or whatever it is, a success. And anybody who has gone to a TNA live event and seen Don West in action, it is an amazing thing to watch. I mean, you get exhausted watching the man just sell shit because he's just... one minute he's in one place, the next minute he's in another. He has people swarming him. He's screaming. He's hollering. His face is beet red. I thought for sure when I was at the last TNA show in Brooklyn back in July, the guy was going to keel over and had a heart attack. Thank God he did not. However, Don West is phenomenal at what he does. I would bring him in and just put him in charge of WWE Shop. He would have this company selling shit at a higher rate than they ever have in their history. So... Don West can join my company any day of the week. Taz. Taz was a very good color commentator in WWE. Left because he just wasn't happy there and went to TNA. Seemingly is very happy there. I would guess one of the things that Taz was not all too thrilled about, as many of the announcers would say, is the fact that he was very limited in what he could say. And he had Vince McMahon in his ear. And he did not like that. Well, one thing that I would do differently, I would not be in the announcer's ear constantly. I mean, if there's cues that need to be given, certainly it can be done. I'm not going to sit there and micromanage and scream and holler in their ears and script out every little thing that they're supposed to say because it doesn't serve any purpose. That makes for shitty commentary. So I would bring Taz back, certainly if he's willing to come back to WWE, and just let him do what he does best. I think he does very well in TNA. And Lord knows there is a huge need for good announced talent. There is a drought of good wrestling announcers. They're hard to come by, and Taz is a talented guy that I wouldn't want to let go. Mike Tenay, not so much. Mike Tenay, I have no interest in bringing him into WWE. Nice guy, I'm sure. He's been a wrestling fan his whole life. He's been in the business for a number of years. I have no use for Mike Tenay on my roster. Borash, Don West, and Taz, yes. Tenay, no. Now, two other things regarding TNA talent. Let's talk about Ric Flair. Ric Flair has not done himself any favors as far as continuing to perform in the ring. He came back out of retirement and soiled the single greatest retirement, the single greatest send-off given to any wrestler in the history of the business. That was his prerogative to do that. Now, I will say this. Ric Flair has been immensely entertaining on the microphone in TNA. As the leader of Fortune, I think that's the role for him to be in. If he's going to be back on TV in any role, as a manager, as a spokesperson, as a guy on the stick, Flair is still better than 90% of the people in the business. I do not, however, need to see Ric Flair wrestling in the ring. He obviously is not what he once was. He's not even what he was 5 years ago. And let's be honest, Ric Flair in the ring 5 years ago wasn't that good either. I cringe to this day every time he takes a back body drop. He's 61 years old. Flair is far more valuable in somebody's corner and on the microphone, managing an AJ Styles, for example, than he is in the ring wrestling. I would not allow Ric Flair to wrestle. I would, however, welcome him back with open arms in much the same role he has now in TNA, because Flair is still goddamn entertaining, and just nobody can deny that. And that brings me to Sting. Now, I feel for Sting because, you know, he's wrestling matches, his shoulder, he suffered a shoulder injury a couple of months ago that is obviously not fully healed, and he's had some pretty bad matches recently. It's not entirely his fault because he's not 100%. All things considered, for a guy his age in his early 50s, Sting still looks pretty good. And, you know, with the face paint and the overcoat, he still has that character. People dig it. You know, people still pop for Sting. And I, for one, think that there are very few dream matches, for lack of a better term, in wrestling. However, one of those dream matches, I think, still is Sting against The Undertaker. I would make that match happen. And in fact, what I would do is offer Sting the Bret Hart treatment. When Bret Hart came back to WWE originally, at the beginning of this year, it was on a 3-month contract. You know, he was going to come in January, which he did, and stay through WrestleMania. The contract that he originally signed was through about a week or two after Mania, and that was going to be it. Of course, Bret ended up either extending the deal or signing a new one and doing more things with WWE. And in fact, this weekend, in fact, tonight, as I record this, Bret Hart is going to be wrestling in Madison Square Garden. His big MSG return, teaming up with the Hart Dynasty against Nexus. I would give Sting the same treatment. I would sign him to a short-term 3-month deal that would kick in at the beginning of next year and take him through just beyond WrestleMania. So maybe his first appearance on pay-per-view is at the Royal Rumble. You build to a program at WrestleMania with him and The Undertaker. Can he break the streak? Here's a match that we've never seen before. The franchise of WCW, and in some ways the franchise of TNA, against the Phenom of the WWE. Two of the biggest stars in wrestling in the 1990s against each other. Still has a lot of appeal. Not only does Sting get a WrestleMania payoff out of it, he gets a Hall of Fame induction, and he gets a DVD release out of it, which makes money for the company, because I think that would be a hot seller. Now, if WrestleMania comes and goes, and Sting is still happy, wants to stick around for a little bit longer, I'd be more than happy to talk turkey with him and see if we could extend that contract for another 6 months, maybe. I mean, Sting is not a long-term solution to anything in wrestling anymore. He's way beyond that point. But I think there's still some value there, and I'm certainly willing to bring him aboard, at the very least, for the Undertaker program, put him in the Hall of Fame, give him a DVD, and at that point, see where we go from there. Beyond that, that's all the talent I would take, at least initially, from TNA, if they went out of business tomorrow. I don't need Hogan. As much as I love him, I don't need Bischoff, I don't need Foley, I don't need Anderson, I don't need Matt Morgan, I don't need Kazarian, I don't need Kevin Nash, I don't need Jeff Jarrett, I don't need anybody else. Those are the only guys that I would take. Then, of course, you have your independent workers, and there's a lot of really good talent out in this country alone, let alone internationally, on the independent circuit. I just jotted down a couple of names that jump out at me. Obviously, Shelton Benjamin and Charlie Haas, who are technically indie workers now. They're not officially with Ring of Honor. That was a one-time match that they had a couple of weeks ago. Ring of Honor, unfortunately, can't really afford them right now, so they have not signed them to contracts. Haas and Benjamin deserve to be working on a national stage. The state of tag team wrestling in WWE is such that, you know, obviously, they're not going to bring them back anytime soon. You know, Benjamin, they let go last year. Haas has said some pretty harsh things about WWE to the point that I don't see them ever taking him back. It's not like he was a big name that one day, you know, they'll forgive and forget. I don't see Charlie Haas ever coming back as long as Vince McMahon is in power. But with the Solomons are in power, Haas and Benjamin would be at the top of my list. And again, they add to an already strong tag division now that I've built up all of a sudden. And there's a couple of other talents, too. There's an independent wrestler who wrestles for Chikara by the name of Chuck Taylor, who I've seen many of his matches. I am amused by him. Ricochet is another young guy on the independent circuit who has some amazing matches. He's a tremendous in-ring performer. Takeshi Morishima, big guy from the Noah promotion. I saw him up close when he came in about a year or two ago for some Ring of Honor shows in Manhattan. A big guy who really needs to lose some weight. Apparently he's already starting to have some knee issues. I think he's actually out with an injury right now. But he reminded me of like an old school guy, like a Vader or a Stan Hansen, just hard hitting, big guy who can do some pretty amazing things for a guy his size. He'd have to lose some weight, but I definitely think there's some value in a guy like that. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Mickie James, who I guess now is technically under contract to TNA. She deserves to be brought back to the WWE Divas division. And Awesome Kong, who I cannot believe, you know, in some ways I guess I can believe, but it's a crime that she has not been given a look, let alone signed to a deal by WWE, because she doesn't fit the look of your generic average WWE diva. Fuck that. If I'm in charge, Awesome Kong is coming into my company. And she is dominating the Divas division. Now, I've gotten email from people also, so I figured I would throw this in there, asking me, what would you do with the NXT Season 2 rookies? How do you think they're going to debut? Look, I don't know how they're going to debut, and I'm not going to get too much into creative stuff. But I will say, as far as what rookies that I believe should be on TV right away, Caval is on TV right now, even though he's completely being underutilized. Caval, Alex Riley, who is now a regular on TV and deserves to be, and Husky Harris deserves to be on TV. In fact, when Skip Sheffield went down with his ankle injury, I would have probably had Husky Harris replace him in Nexus. Husky Harris deserves a spot on TV right now. Michael McGillicuddy, however, I'd keep him down in FCW. I was not overly impressed watching him as far as in the ring and on promos. I think he needs a little more work. I'd keep him down in developmental. So those are the NXT Season 2 rookies that I would use on TV right now. Now, as far as NXT Season 3 and the Divas are concerned, I give you this quote. This was a quote from Lance Storm from his website, stormwrestling.com. I'm going to read this to you. Quote, "My biggest complaint with the Divas NXT season is the experience level of the girls. I don't think that most of them are ready for TV. Instead of being a pro on the show, as somebody suggested that perhaps Lance should be, I would rather have WWE send some of these girls to SWA for me to work with them for a few months to better prepare them for NXT. Now, for those of you who don't know, Lance Storm runs his own school up in Canada called the Storm Wrestling Academy. And Lance actually has some experience working with the Divas, because before he left WWE, he was working as a trainer, and he was working quite a bit with the Divas, much like Fit Finlay used to do. That quote right there says it all. If I were in charge of WWE, I'd be picking up the phone yesterday to call Lance Storm and have him work with each one of those girls, because they all need help. NXT in its current form is the greatest train wreck on TV, but it's completely counterproductive to what they're supposed to be doing, which is putting over new talent. So I would take Lance's advice. Here's a guy who's willing to help. He has proven before that he's pretty damn good at it. I'd be calling up Lance and sending all of the NXT Divas to the Storm Wrestling Academy tomorrow if I were in charge of WWE. And just to round things out here, I mentioned Mike McGillicuddy before, going back down to FCW. Just for the record, the other NXT people from Season 1 and Season 2 who I think need to be sent back down to FCW to work on their craft a little bit more. Michael Tarver, who was really not that good. Darren Young, or Black Cena as I like to call him. Lucky Cannon, Percy Watson, and even though she wasn't an NXT diva, Lacey Von Erich needs all the help that she can get. I cannot believe, as beautiful as she is, that a woman with the pedigree that she has, you know, her father was a wrestler, she comes from a wrestling family, is as god-awful in the ring as she is. And she's been in TNA now for a couple of years, she's been wrestling matches, she's been on TV, great eye candy, a great valet, horrible, horrible wrestler. It might be a lost cause. In fact, WWE had her in developmental years ago, and they actually cut her loose. I mean, imagine that. A girl that looks like Lacey Von Erich does, and they got rid of her. They fired her because they thought that she was beyond help. Now, I tend to be a little more optimistic. I'd like to think that not everybody is beyond help, so I think some time down in developmental might do her some good. So that's who I would send down to Florida. And the last thing as far as the roster is concerned here, and it's always a tough thing to do, and it's really easy to sit here and say, I'm going to get rid of this person, I'm going to get rid of that person. But the fact is, when you're in charge, you got to make the tough decisions. And in this case, you got to trim the fat. If you're going to be bringing in, if I'm going to be bringing in all of this excess talent from Ring of Honor, from TNA, from the Independents, a lot of them may go down to developmental for a while. You can't put them all on the active roster at once. However, if you're going to be hiring all these people, you've got to get rid of some people too. You know, you can't just hire everybody and keep adding and adding and adding to your roster. Otherwise, you become WCW in the late 90s, where they literally would hire people at contracts that were six figures. And essentially, they would pay them to stay home and do nothing. That would not be the best philosophy to live by. So, people have to be cut. Now, who would I get rid of? Who do you think is at the top of my list? Matt Hardy has earned himself a spot at the top of the cut list. He would be gone. Adios. Great Kali. Look, I thought they should have gotten rid of Kali years ago. And look what Kali has done. Kali has gone from a heel to a babyface. He's been built up as a monster. He's been built up as a comedy figure. He's been a world heavyweight freaking champion, for crying out loud, which was a crime in and of itself. I think even Batista had said in an interview that that was just criminal, the fact that they put the belt on him. They have gotten everything they're going to get out of Kali. I would cut the big guy loose. Joey Mercury, Chavo Guerrero, who I've never really liked Chavo as a performer. Not that he's a bad wrestler. He just doesn't do anything for me. So I would get rid of him. Tyler Rex, Kurt Hawkins, Vance Archer, Kalen Croft, Trent Beretta. Why are these people under contract? Unless you're going to use them as job talent, which they're not really doing, get rid of them. You're not doing anything with them. They don't serve any purpose. David Otunga, adios. Titus O'Neil, sayonara. Eli Cottonwood, good luck in the future. Jillian Hall, again, she's not a horrible wrestler, but I think, you know, on my roster, we have enough divas as it is. And quite frankly, chauvinist as it may sound, not that every diva has to look like a swimsuit model, but, you know, Jillian never really did anything to float my boat. So Tiffany, who I think is already pretty much gone from WWE, would be cut. And the Bella Twins, who were probably the two biggest whores on the entire Raw roster, can do their whoring somewhere else. So that is the fat that I would trim from the roster. So let's move away from roster stuff here for a second. Let's talk about developmental, since we were on that subject, kind of. Where do you begin with developmental? First of all, WWE used to have more than one developmental territory, for lack of a better term. Of course, OVW, Ohio Valley Wrestling, is where a lot of names cut their teeth. They learn from Jim Cornette, Danny Davis, a lot of great trainers in Louisville, in OVW, training people. Nick Dinsmore, who of course would become Eugene, but pre-Eugene was a pretty damn fine wrestler, was in OVW and actually still does teach in OVW. Shelton Benjamin, Brock Lesnar, a lot of people came from Ohio Valley Wrestling. And it was a shame when they cut ties with them. And they also had some ties to Les Thatcher's Heartland Wrestling Association, the HWA. They had ties to Rick Baseman's UPW in California, which is where Samoa Joe and John Cena, actually, who came up in the same class, were discovered. And they decided to consolidate their operations into one promotion that they created it from scratch down in Florida, in Tampa. And there is a lot of WWE talent based in the Tampa area. So the logic there is you can have a lot of wrestlers from WWE on their days off make appearances in FCW and help out, which they do from time to time. But truth be told, it's not like WWE guys are there every week. You know, it's not like it's making that much of a big difference, the fact that you're based in Florida. They put Steve Kern, who, you know, many WWF fans would know him as the Alligator Man Skinner from the early 90s. They put him in charge. I know Billy Kidman is a trainer down there. Dusty Rhodes does the announcing for the TV show, and he helps out down there as well. You know, I can't help but think that it would be beneficial. I am intrigued by the idea of having 3 to 4 additional territories, for lack of a better term, where talent can rotate to gain experience and make a name for themselves. So, you know, if you want to keep FCW in Florida and perhaps contract once again with OVW and maybe either contract with a different promotion that's somewhere in the Midwest, if you want to create another one. I mean, creating one from scratch like they did with FCW and pouring your own resources into it is more costly. To me, WWE is being really cheap. They do not pump a lot of money at all into their developmental operations. Relative to the money they have on hand, it's nothing. You may remember Deep South Wrestling, you know, which was run by Jody Hamilton, one of the former Assassins. And that was also a developmental promotion for WWE for a while before WWE came in and shut them down. And there was a big lawsuit that came out of that. And the fact is, if you have three or four different areas, it would be very similar to the old territorial days where everybody is under the same umbrella. So the goal is obvious. You have three or four different promotions. The goal here is to groom talent that will eventually go on to be TV ready for WWE. That's the goal. So you have talent like a Mike McGillicuddy or somebody like that who can go from FCW, and maybe they've been in FCW for 6 months or a year and a half, and they've won the title and they've done everything they could possibly do. And he rotates into Ohio Valley. You know, goes to Ohio Valley, makes a name for himself there. Maybe you have a champion from FCW going to one of the other promotions to defend the belt. They can rotate from one to the other. You get more seasoning that way because you're performing in front of a different audience. You're hearing from different trainers who can give you different types of feedback to your work instead of just being around the same one or two trainers all the time. And plus, you're making a name for yourself in front of a different crowd in three or four different places. So I like that idea, and I would definitely push for something like that instead of just having FCW. Now, here's something that troubles me. It's a state of mind. It's a philosophy that WWE has that I vehemently disagree with. Now, this is a quote that comes from a recent report in the Wrestling Observer newsletter. There was some discussion about how the developmental is going and some of the talents down there. And, you know, Dave Meltzer talked to some key people. And this is a quote from The Observer. And this speaks volumes. Quote, "The key here is that the company is not looking for accomplished workers. They would in many cases rather have tall guys with good bodies and good faces who are young and have never worked, so they can train them from scratch in their style." End quote. I disagree with this, as I said. I feel it's much better to feature multiple styles than just one style of working. You have some guys currently under contract at WWE, on the main roster, in fact. You have Daniel Bryan. You have David Hart Smith. You actually have a guy down in FCW right now who's getting a lot of praise. The son of Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, Richie Steamboat. These are guys that have trained in different places, in different parts of the world, whether it's Europe, Canada, Japan, Mexico. They are groomed in a lot of different styles. And basically what WWE likes to do when they bring you aboard is they want you to forget about everything you've ever learned, and they want to train you in the WWE safe style. And that's the way they want you to work. Well, it's their company. They can do what they want to. But again, in this scenario, it's now my company. And I think that it is beneficial to know many different styles. It makes you a more well-rounded performer. And quite frankly, not everybody looks the same. And that's a good thing. You don't want everybody to look like a robot where they're wrestling the same way. Their promos are all the same wooden promos. You've got a guy who maybe learned the style in Japan in the ring with a guy who learned this style in Mexico. And yeah, I mean, if you have a clash in styles, it can make for a bad match. But I think that's the way to go. This whole philosophy about, okay, this guy looks good and all jacked up, so you know, let's pluck him out of the mix and just teach him the WWE style is horse shit. You know, if you're just going to look for tall guys with good bodies, think about it like this. If all you're looking for are pretty faces and big jacked up bodies, guys like Arn Anderson, Dusty Rhodes, Jake the Snake Roberts, even Ric Flair and Shawn Michaels, two of the greatest performers in the history of the business, they would have been called too small. They would have never gotten a second look. Jake Roberts, he doesn't look like a wrestler. Dusty Rhodes, he's too fat. Arn Anderson, he looks like a lumberjack. It's ridiculous. Imagine all of the guys. Hulk Hogan probably would have gotten a look. Because again, at the time, he was big, he was jacked, he was tanned. He had the good promo ability. Hogan still would have gotten over. But those guys, they would have been kicked out the door. And that's got to change, because imagine all the great talent in the last 5 or 10 years that could have been in the company right now that is now doing something else, like, for example, mixed martial arts. The biggest thing that I could say about developmental in terms of a change that I would make, now I know for a fact that right now WWE has Jim Ross and Gerald Briscoe playing the role of scout in terms of, you know, Ross and Briscoe will recommend real sports athletes that they think WWE should sign or go after. Jim Ross does make trips down to Florida to evaluate the talent, and I think that's great. I think they should continue to have JR and Briscoe do exactly what they're doing. They should make scouting trips and submit reports to management. However, you need to take it one step further. If I'm in charge, I say this. Developmental is your future, and the future is now. Triple H, Chris Jericho, Edge, The Undertaker, Kane, these guys are not going to be around much longer. And it's great that they've made some new stars in Sheamus and The Miz, and they're trying with guys like Wade Barrett and Alberto Del Rio. But the fact is, you're going to need more than that. And there's no guarantee that every guy I just mentioned is going to become a big star. I mean, they're well on their way. They're being given a chance, but Kofi Kingston was given a chance, and then he had his legs cut out from underneath him. I don't know that Kofi will ever be able to recover from that. It is a pattern of behavior with WWE where they try to get you over and they try to knock you down. What I think needs to happen is this. They need to pump more money into the operation. I would allot a certain amount of money to developmental, and the big thing that I would do is this. Hire a team, and I'm not just talking about Ross and Briscoe. Hire a team of WWE scouts whose sole job it is to visit independent events throughout the world. Not just the U.S., the world. To observe talent and submit evaluations to management. And this is a regular thing, whether it's twice a month, once a month, it doesn't have to be every week. This has to happen. You have to have a team of 6 guys. 2 guys in the U.S., let's say. You have a guy in Europe. You have a guy in Mexico. You have a guy in Japan. They scout talent. That is their job. They come back. They report back to me. They report back to WWE management with reports on who looks good and who doesn't. Who's worth it to go after? Who do you see money in? Who do you see some raw talent in? I don't think they're doing that right now. And that's something they need to do. They need to have their own team of people that they send out there to do that very thing. And the last thing about developmental here, enough with the cartoon names. You know, they'll bring somebody into developmental and they'll take away their name and they'll give them some ridiculous name. No more of that shit. You know, it just kills a guy's career before it even has a chance to start. And then training for announcers and managers, that's the other thing. They, you know, WWE, like I said before, they have an announcer shortage. They really haven't trained anybody suitable to replace Jim Ross, because Michael Cole don't count, as good as he's been of late. And nobody's ever going to be like Jim Ross. But the fact is, they should have a couple of guys coming up in the system who, you know, can be, you know, perhaps somebody who can replace these play-by-play guys in a couple of years. And they could be the next generation, the next wave of guys. You know, they've got people like Byron Saxton down in FCW. When he was on ECW, he wasn't all that great. But apparently in FCW, he's really, really good. So I don't know why that is. But you need to have some formal training as part of the developmental program for potential announcers and also managers. I say let's put the emphasis back not only on tag team wrestling, but on managers. That's why I said before, I was very happy to hear that Paul Bearer was brought back. There's no telling how long he'll be back for. It could be a couple of weeks. It could be a couple of months. But there needs to be a greater emphasis on managers in WWE. You know, there's no reason a guy like the Sinister Minister, Jim Mitchell, should be sitting on the unemployment line. You know, if I'm bringing Abyss into the company, if I have Kane on the roster, those are two prime examples of guys that Jim Mitchell could and should be managing right now. You've got Joel Gertner, who was probably one of the more entertaining things from what people have said at the TNA Hardcore Justice pay-per-view. He was from the old ECW. He's this greasy, fat, slimy-looking manager. He'd come out with the neck brace, all the sexual innuendo. He certainly was not TVPG. Joel Gertner deserves to be working as a manager. Larry Sweeney. Anybody who's familiar with Larry Sweeney, who's a wrestler-slash-manager on the independent circuit, I know Sweeney's had some issues in recent years. He is bipolar. He went a little cuckoo for a while. Apparently, he's gotten his issues under control, which is good, because Sweeney is a tremendous talent. from what I've seen of him wrestle, he's a fine wrestler. So is Bobby Heenan. But guess what? Bobby Heenan's gift was his gift of gab. That's where he made his money. That's where he made his legend as a manager and as an announcer. And I think that is the same thing that Larry Sweeney needs to be doing. He needs to be working for a national company. He needs to be working for my company, managing somebody, managing a stable of people. The creative team. Now, I'm not going to spend too much time on the creative team. I'm not going to say who I would bring in to be on my creative team. I will tell you this much. No more Hollywood soap opera writers. Out. We don't need them. WWE did fine without them in the 90s, and they'll do fine without them in 2011 and beyond. Think about it like this. You know, when WWE TV was so much better, which for the most part it was in the late 90s, if you look back compared to the way it is now, you had one or two men writing TV each week with Vince McMahon as a filter. You had Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara, who again came up with some zany ideas, but Vince McMahon was there to filter those ideas, to shoot down the really bad ones, and to take some of the crazier ones and make them work. It was a small group of guys. You didn't have an entire team of writing people. You don't need that. It's not a sitcom. It's not a drama. It's not a feature film. You don't need that. And the fact is, with Vince McMahon gone and the Solo Monster in power, you don't need writers anymore to write to please Vince and make him laugh. There's a lot of people who are probably very, very creative people who work for WWE, but they don't have the opportunity to show that because they're afraid it might cost them their job if they write shit that Vince McMahon or Stephanie McMahon won't like. Well, guess what? With the McMahons out of power, they don't have to worry about that anymore. But I don't think you need a whole team of people. There's a couple of people out there who are very knowledgeable in wrestling booking who have their finger on the pulse of what people want. I think Paul Heyman is one of those people. I said that Paul Heyman was not going to go to TNA. I just could not see it happening. And, of course, Paul Heyman did not, as of yet, go to TNA. Now, I'm not saying that if I were in charge, I would pick up the phone, call Paul Heyman, and give him the power to do what he wants to with my product. I can understand to a degree where Dixie Carter is coming from, in that it's hard to admit that you're wrong. And it's hard to say that I'm going to bring somebody in who is potentially a loose cannon, who, even though he has a proven track record, I've never worked with him and I don't know what he's all about. And I'm just going to give him the power to do whatever he wants. I could see where she would have some trepidation doing that. And I can't sit here and say that I would be willing to do that myself. I would think that I have better sense than the people who are currently running the show there, and that I would need Paul Heyman to come in and overhaul everything. But Paul Heyman is somebody I would definitely consider bringing aboard in some capacity to help out or to contribute ideas. Same thing with Dutch Mantel. Same thing with Jim Cornette. You know, some of these guys are older, but they have a proven track record of knowing what works and what doesn't. They know how to book wrestling, not to book a TV show. And there's a big difference there. Pay-per-views. This is the biggie. This is what I have a lot written down here for. Now, again, I want to give you a quote. This comes from a recent pay-per-view survey that was conducted by Brian Alvarez of Figure Four Weekly. So I want to read this quick quote to you. Quote, wrestling fans noted that WWE produces at least 6 hours of first-run television per week and then asks viewers to pay up to $54.95 for HD for shows that many people call glorified Raws. The issue with oversaturation is actually not that there's too many events, but rather there's too many expensive events that don't feel important, end quote. Now, there may be quite a bit of truth to this, but the fact is WWE does not leave enough time between shows to adequately promote them. Case in point, we've got a Hell in a Cell pay-per-view coming up on October 3rd. Now, WWE just came off Night of Champions, and they taped two editions of Raw this past Monday, which means all of their TV, as far as Raw goes, has already been taped for the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view. They've got one show between now and then. That's the live SmackDown next Friday. That's it. There's 2 weeks between Night of Champions and Hell in a Cell. That is not acceptable. You can't do that. And even between Hell in a Cell and Bragging Rights is what? 3 weeks. Bragging Rights is going to die a horrible death next month. And they've done nothing to establish Bragging Rights as a pay-per-view that I should buy. I mean, they trotted a trophy out last year that they didn't even tell people about in advance. Chris Jericho walked around with it for about 3 weeks on TV, and you never saw the trophy again. But anyway, back to the pay-per-view prices. there's a couple of ways you can go with this. You can keep the current number of shows, which is 13, I believe, and you can simply slash the price. Excuse me, slash the price point from $44.95, which is the standard definition price, back down to the old $34.95. Or you can reduce the number of pay-per-view shows, let's say to like 8, and keep the price point as it is. I have chosen to go a more radical route. My pay-per-view lineup would look a little bit like this. Royal Rumble in January. WrestleMania in late March, early April. A pay-per-view, to be determined what it's called, in mid-May. King of the Ring brought back in late June. SummerSlam in late August. A pay-per-view to be determined in mid-October. And the Survivor Series in November. So essentially, you're going from 13 pay-per-view shows per year to 7. Now, keep in mind, wrestlers are going from 13 pay-per-view payoffs per year for the people who actually get on pay-per-view to 7. So they're probably not going to be too happy about this, but that's too damn bad. Now, I did give some thought to just going back down to the traditional big 5, including King of the Ring, which I would bring back. I like the King of the Ring concept. But when I looked at the lineup, there were gaps. So instead of doing 5 pay-per-views, I figured 7 is a better number. You have a gap between WrestleMania and the King of the Ring where you can put a pay-per-view in there and you still have 6 weeks to promote it. Same thing with October. You've got a nice big gap between SummerSlam and Survivor Series. Things aren't quite, you know, the way they used to be. You can put a show in there and still have 6 weeks to hype it up. So I go with 7 pay-per-views. Instead of 13. Now, I admit that it may not make sense to some people. You know, according to Dave Meltzer, WWE only needs 75,000 worldwide buys per pay-per-view to break even on these shows. They've been cutting costs recently with Pyro and the set and other things. All they need to do is get 75,000 people around the world to buy a specific pay-per-view show, and they've already broke even on it. Anything after that is a profit for them. That's why they continue to have 13 shows a year, because they make money off them. What I'm saying is, I'm acknowledging that you need to sacrifice something for long-term gain. You have to sacrifice money in the short term in order for it to pay off in the long term. 13 is still too many shows to have each year. It's unsustainable. The way that they do their product now and the way they hype up their pay-per-views is shit. It's unsustainable. And even if I was to do a better job hyping up these pay-per-views as head of WWE, it's still too many shows. 7 is a much better number. Now, one of the things I'd be doing in the process is getting rid of all these new gimmick pay-per-views, which is a good thing. They're killing these gimmicks. Hell in a Cell could still work. A Hell in a Cell pay-per-view every year at the same time, you're boxing yourself in a corner. They don't have any feuds right now that deserve to be contested inside the cell. I don't need to see Sheamus and Randy Orton in a cell. This is not a blood feud that's been going on for months. Why does it have to be in a cage? And you're going to have 2 cell matches in 1 pay-per-view? I think they had 3 of them last year. That's ridiculous. Now, Hell in a Cell, I will say, and TLC are 2 of the gimmick shows that did pretty good last year. I don't think they're going to do as good this year. You know, TLC is the same thing. Breaking Point was that submission pay-per-view last year, which did awful, so they got rid of it. Money in the Bank, it was a great show, but it tanked on pay-per-view. It did awful. You don't need pay-per-views with these stupid gimmicks, so I'd get rid of them. Survivor Series is interesting. How do you salvage Survivor Series? I mean, WWE got rid of the pay-per-view, and then they brought it back because they couldn't come up with something better. The reason Survivor Series didn't do well last year was not because of the name. It was because they didn't promote it the right way. But the fact is, the Survivor Series elimination concept is outdated. I will admit that. Those matches worked better in the late 80s and the early 90s. The Survivor Series actually started losing its appeal, to be honest with you, in the mid-90s. It just doesn't work as a pay-per-view concept. People aren't going to pay $50 to see teams of 5 go at it in a regular match. When they can see matches like that on Raw or on SmackDown. Now, for years, I have been saying that WWE owns the copyright. Why not use the War Games concept at Survivor Series? It makes sense, just in terms of the names. War Games at Survivor Series. You don't need a series of elimination matches anymore. Once a year, you feature a 5-on-5, double ring, double cage War Games match. Nobody's ever seen anything like that in WWE. The Elimination Chamber is a poor man's War Games. I think that concept would sell. As far as what the teams would be, you know, if they had built this Nexus thing up a little bit better, it would have made perfect sense to do Team WWE against Nexus in a War Games match at Survivor Series instead of doing what they did at SummerSlam, but that's neither here nor there. The fact is, I would make War Games the new annual Survivor Series tradition. I think that would work out quite well. Now, the King of the Ring pay-per-view, before they discontinued it, they were kind of half-assing it. You know, the King of the Ring tournament in its entirety aired on pay-per-view the first 3 years they did it. And then starting from 96 on, when Austin first won, they would only show the semifinals and the finals. And to me, it made the tournament less special. If you're not going to show the whole thing, why do it at all? Now, with all the talent on the roster, you can have a 16-man bracket. But the fact is, when you get to the final eight, which is essentially the quarterfinals on, you've got to have that entire tournament air on the pay-per-view itself. And you've got to make the winner of King of the Ring get something out of it. It's not just the stupid crown and a scepter. You can say the winner of the King of the Ring tournament automatically becomes the number one contender for the WWE Championship, and they earn themselves an automatic title match at SummerSlam, which is kind of how it used to be. That's how I would handle the King of the Ring concept. Money in the Bank, in case you couldn't already tell, reinstated as a WrestleMania match, which ironically may happen anyway from what I hear in 2011, but Money in the Bank does not need to be its own pay-per-view. It needs to stay at WrestleMania. Excuse me. Couple of other thoughts here. Again, these are kind of minor things, but whatever happened to pre-match and post-match interviews? You don't really see them too much anymore. I would bring that back. I think it's, in a way, it's kind of a lost art. It adds a little something, especially to the main event matches. Howard Finkel should be announcing pay-per-views. I have no problem keeping Justin Roberts on as the Raw ring announcer and Tony Chimmel as the SmackDown ring announcer, but God damn it. Howard Finkel deserves to be ring announcing on pay-per-views. I actually was happy to read earlier today that Howard Finkel apparently is doing the announcing at the Madison Square Garden show tonight for Bret Hart's return. Good for him. He deserves it. He is the greatest ring announcer in the history of the business. And it's a crime that he has not been utilized more than he has been. He's not getting any younger. And the fact is, you don't know what you got till it's gone. Howard deserves to be calling those pay-per-views. Now, two final things here on pay-per-views. First of all, Jim Ross. Jim Ross, in a perfect world, if I were in charge of WWE, would be announcing special events. And by that I mean pay-per-views specifically like WrestleMania, Royal Rumble, SummerSlam, Survivor Series, maybe all the pay-per-views, maybe just WrestleMania. I don't know. That would have to be worked out with JR. But Jim Ross's announcing day should not be completely over. He has said that he actually is fine with not being on the road every week. He does not envision himself ever going back to doing Raw every week. Now, that doesn't mean if I offered it to him that he wouldn't take it, but I get that. And I would not bring Jim Ross back as the Raw play-by-play guy. I would use him for special events like pay-per-views, assuming that he does not get the Oklahoma Sooners radio gig, which he may be in the running for. The big thing here is, this is my idea that I kind of had. I've had this for a while now, and I really think they're missing the ball by not doing this. I am a big proponent of toning down the comedy and making WWE more realistic. More like a sport, quite frankly. It doesn't have to be serious all the time. I mean, wrestling was built on over-the-top characters and storylines and things of that nature. But pre- and post-game, for lack of a better term, pay-per-view shows, a pay-per-view pre-show, like a pre-game show and a post-game show, I don't know why they don't do this. All you need to do is set up a little shitty set backstage where the announcers can sit before the pay-per-view, half an hour before the show goes on the air. instead of that pre-taped preview show where you show a whole bunch of videos, the same videos that we're going to see on pay-per-view anyway, why don't you have a live deal backstage, a nice little set that you've erected? You've got Michael Cole sitting there and Josh Matthews and maybe Taz is with them. And they're basically hyping up the pay-per-view. They're live. They're backstage. They're talking about the key matches. Maybe you show one video package. You bring a wrestler over. You interview him on set. You know, stuff like that. Then you go into the pay-per-view. When the pay-per-view is over, more often than not, the pay-per-view, you'll notice, goes off the air early. Sometimes it goes off the air 5 minutes early. Sometimes it goes off the air 20 minutes early, which, in my opinion, is a ripoff. So, in terms of the post-game pay-per-view shows, all you need to do is utilize whatever satellite time you have left. So if your pay-per-view goes off the air at 10:41 p.m. Eastern Time, fade to black, run a quick commercial for Raw the next night, and when you come back 30 seconds later or 60 seconds later, you're backstage at the set, the announcers are there, and you've got a little bit of time to kind of analyze what you just saw, the big angle that just went down, the big title change that just occurred. You talk about what just happened on the pay-per-view. You hype up Raw the next night. Maybe you have a wrestler who competed. You bring him on over. You interview him really quick about his match or his victory or his loss or whatever. And it all depends on how much time you have left. So if the pay-per-view goes off the air 10 minutes early, it's going to be a short post-game show. And if the pay-per-view goes off the air 20 minutes early, it'll be a longer post-game show. That way you're giving people something for their money. And when you reach the top of the hour, then the replay of the pay-per-view goes on. I just don't understand why they've never tried anything like that. Even if they did it on WWE.com, they really need to get on the ball and do something like this. It really goes a long way to help make their shows feel that much more important. Let's talk about television here, which is kind of important, obviously. I want to start off with NXT. Now, when NXT was first announced, I had high hopes. I was actually really excited. The way they were talking about it, it sounded like a more modern-day version of the old Tough Enough show on MTV. And like I said, I was pretty amped up about that idea. And then I saw the first episode of NXT. And I felt completely deflated because I looked at it as a missed opportunity. And sure enough, I mean, like I said earlier, NXT is the greatest train wreck on television today. It's entertaining as hell to watch. And people say, well, that's all that matters, as long as it's entertaining. Well, you know what? That's not all that matters. Because this is not Raw. This is not SmackDown. This is NXT. This is the show that was designed to get new talent over to the audience. That's the whole purpose of NXT. So, you can't sit there and say, well, it's entertaining, so who cares? You're completely being counterproductive. You're not making any new stars. You're completely burying them. You're having your own lead announcer go out there and acknowledge the fact that this show sucks, which is the God's honest truth, but I don't know that I want my lead announcer going out there saying that this show sucks. So the entire NXT concept needs to be overhauled, entertaining as it may be. There is no shame in, let's just say, borrowing an idea. Because let's be honest, in wrestling, ideas are recycled and stolen all the time. So why not suck it up and admittedly steal an idea, steal a page out of the UFC playbook and essentially craft NXT into the type of show that Ultimate Fighter is. Now, for those of you who don't know, Ultimate Fighter, which is actually, I think the show is in its 11th or 12th season now. That show's kind of running out of steam, actually, but it's been on the air now for a couple of years. And very entertaining. And essentially the way it works is you have a certain number of guys who are divided into two teams. Each team is led by a designated UFC fighter. At the end of the season, those two UFC fighters will have a pay-per-view match against each other. So, in part, the whole purpose of Ultimate Fighter is to hype up a big money match between these two UFC fighters. That's part of what the show is there for. The show is also designed to get over a new crop of faces to the audience and hopefully build at least one big new UFC star. And a lot of stars have been built from that show. I say, if the formula works for UFC, there's no reason it wouldn't work for WWE. Before the season starts, you make a big announcement on Raw. Two WWE pros have been chosen to lead their respective teams on the next season of NXT. Now, ironically, before Matt Hardy went all batty a couple of weeks ago, I actually figured I was going to have Matt Hardy and Christian as the two coaches for my first NXT season. And then, of course, Matt Hardy went all nutty and Christian got hurt, so that wouldn't work. But it doesn't matter who you pick. You pick two guys. They could be mid-card guys. They could be upper mid-card guys. It could be one main eventer and one mid-carder. And they will lead their respective teams on NXT. You have 10 guys divided into teams of five. Maybe you might even have some women in there. 5-on-5. And they coach their own teams. They don't even have to live in a house together or anything like that. I mean, they could, but you follow them around in their everyday life. You follow the two teams around. You follow them in training. You show how the pro teaches them, what advice they give them. You do personality profiles on each of the guys so we get to learn a little bit more about them, about their background. You show them being trained in FCW or OVW, one of the developmental systems, wherever they do their training. At the end of each episode, the pro for their respective team has chosen one of his rookies to have a match with a rookie from the other team. Now, obviously, in UFC, it's a real fight. That's how each episode ends. The two guys have a fight. Whoever wins stays. The loser is gone. In WWE, it's not a real fight. We know that. However, you're judging them not on their real grappling ability. You're judging them on their work inside the ring. You're judging them on how fluid they are. If that week they were working on running the ropes and doing monkey flips and maybe in their match they don't do a very good job, that's points off. You have a panel of three judges, whoever those judges are, that are going to be watching these matches and judging and grading, scoring these people. And you judge them on their in-ring work, you could judge them on their promo ability, how they interact with the audience, if there are fans in attendance at these little shows, and whoever gets the lowest score is eliminated. It follows the same general concept of Ultimate Fighter. So again, it serves two purposes. Number one, you're trying to get these guys over because a lot of these guys are going to end up on the WWE roster. Some of them may stay in developmental, but some of them are going to make it to the main roster, and the winner of NXT, you would hope, goes on to become a big star. In addition, your two WWE pros, whoever they may be, over the course of that 10-week season or 12-week season, they're building to a pay-per-view match, maybe at SummerSlam or whatever, against each other. These guys have been going back and forth, jaw-jacking back and forth on this show for 12 weeks. You now have a reason to want to see these two guys have a match on pay-per-view, and this isn't even going to be your pay-per-view main event, but you've now promoted potentially a big-money match. It's a win-win situation. But it takes a commitment to make this a serious show and not a complete joke. I'm willing to make that commitment. Apparently, Vince McMahon and WWE, they don't take NXT seriously enough to do that, and that's a shame. That's the concept that NXT should be. That's how it should have been done in the first place. That's how I would do it. I would kill the guest star concept on Raw. They're guest stars now, by the way, not guest hosts. That goes out the window. That certainly has run its course. Raw and SmackDown sets could probably benefit from a makeover. I've become quite a fan of those old WCW Nitro setups with the little set in the long aisleway. Again, compared to these other issues, it's a minor thing. It's more of a, you know, it's a vanity issue. But that's one change I might make, just to make the shows look a little bit fresher. Less scripted interviews. I can't emphasize that enough. I mean, that's the biggest one of the biggest changes WWE has made in the last decade, compared to the Attitude Era and all those other prior eras. Everything is scripted word for word. Very few veterans even are allowed to kind of go out there with bullet points and do their own thing. That has to change. People have to learn to sink or swim on their own. They need to learn how to cut promos without an actual script in front of them. They don't need to go out. It's not about going out there and saying a bunch of memorized lines. It's about going out there and knowing what you want to talk about and delivering a promo in your own voice. That's what you need. That's what needs to be taught in developmental, and that's the way it needs to work on TV. Because I watch these TV shows as a fan now, and it's a joke. It is an absolute joke. It sounds wooden, it sounds fake, it sounds rehearsed, and yes, we all know wrestling is fake, but the fact is it shouldn't look fake and it shouldn't sound fake. And by the way, whatever happened to the old stationary backstage camera angle? Remember when me and Gene used to do interviews back in the day? You had that one camera from a distance zooming in. It was one camera shot, dead straight on, me and Gene standing there with a wrestler, and the wrestler would actually look into the camera. What a concept. He wasn't looking off to the side. He wasn't looking down. He wasn't looking up. He wasn't looking at Mean Gene the whole time. He was looking straight ahead into the camera. And every now and then, the camera angle would shift over to camera number two, off to the side, and the wrestler would shift his eyes and look into that camera. And eventually it would shift back to the hard camera. We need to go back to that. It's just one of these minor things that just bugs the shit out of me. When Randy Orton is standing backstage being interviewed by Josh Matthews, and he's staring at Josh 75% of the time, and the other 35%, or 25% rather, he's staring off into the distance. I don't know if he's reading cue cards. I don't know if he's watching a car chase backstage, perhaps, or if there's perhaps a makeout session in progress with Triple H and Stephanie. I don't know what he's watching. But you need to look into the camera angle. You're talking to us. You're not talking to them. And the other thing here, as far as TV is concerned, backstage pay-per-view updates. You can use Josh Matthews for it, Jeremy Borash, Don West. I don't care who you use. Once or twice per show. Again, it's an old-school thing. Maybe I'm too old-school. But it helps to hype your pay-per-views up if once or twice a show. Kind of like those old Event Center updates. You go backstage. You don't have the audience in the background. You know, it's not just the announcers sitting at ringside running down a couple of matches. You have a pay-per-view report. Oh, we got SummerSlam coming up in 5 weeks. Here are the matches that have been announced so far. And let's go to this interview that we did with Dolph Ziggler and Vicky Guerrero earlier today, or something like that. So those are some of the TV changes that I would make. As far as the announcers are concerned, like I said, Jim Ross is not coming back to Raw. Jim Ross does not want to come back to Raw, and that's fine. If Taz comes back to WWE, which I would certainly bring him back, I think Michael Cole and Taz, who had great chemistry together as a SmackDown announce team for many years, they deserve to be the announcers on Raw. I think Taz brings something out of Cole that Jerry Lawler simply does not. And Cole and Taz, I think, at least deserve a trial run as a tag team at the Raw announce booth. Josh Matthews and Jerry Lawler might actually make for a better team on SmackDown. I think that's the change I would initially make. I would put Taz and Cole together on Raw and have Lawler and Matthews on SmackDown. The website, WWE.com. Joey Styles has got to step his game up. There's been some big fuck-ups on the website over the last few months. The biggest one came, of course, during SummerSlam when WWE.com spoiled their own surprise by announcing that Daniel Bryan was back. And this was before Daniel Bryan even came out for the main event. That was bad. And I don't know exactly who made that error, but the fact is Joey Styles is in charge of WWE.com. And you know, at the end of the day, you got to take responsibility if you're the head guy. So any more fuck-ups like that, and Joey Styles is going to be hitting the bricks. But as far as the website is concerned, two things. First of all, one concept I like that TNA... has. They have this Spin Cycle show, which is basically, it's like a debate format. Usually Jeremy Borash moderates, and you have four people. It's at this table they sit at. And they go around the horn, and they debate not only wrestling topics, but just kind of general current events topics or pop culture topics. And it's actually very entertaining because they're allowed to be themselves. You know, they're not always in character. A lot of these people have a sense of humor that you don't necessarily see on TV. I like Spin Cycle. I think it's a good concept, and I think Jeremy Borash should bring Spin Cycle to WWE.com, have a show once a week, and I think it would be very entertaining. Speaking of which, sorry about that, WWE used to have a little show called Bite This. I know a lot of you remember Bite This and miss Bite This. It's been gone now for a couple of years, and what happened was they had too many smart-ass people calling in, mentioning TNA and doing just generally stupid shit like that. And so they got scared and they took the site. The funny thing is they took the show off the site temporarily. It was a temporary hiatus. That's a long hiatus. It's been, what, 3-4 years now? 5 years maybe? That's a long hiatus. Anyway, I think it's about time we bring Bite This back to WWE.com. And again, once a week, you have, whether it's Todd Grisham or who I would take off TV. I don't buy Todd Grisham as a play-by-play guy, but I think he does fine in settings like this. Whether it's Joey Styles himself or Josh Matthews or Todd Grisham or Don West, you have somebody with or without a co-host. hosting Bite This. They talk about what's been going on that week in WWE. You might have a wrestler in studio or on the phone for an interview. The key to Bite This was the fan interaction. Spin Cycle doesn't have that, but Bite This would. It would have fan interaction, so we could take live phone calls. And, of course, if people try sabotaging the show, you don't have to do live phone calls. You could take emails. You could take messages on Twitter and Facebook. Answer Q&As and stuff like that. So, again, it's just an added incentive, I think, to go to the website. The wellness policy. I don't have a lot to say about the wellness policy. I am not completely well-versed in the wellness policy, so I cannot sit here and pass judgment on WWE for what they do or don't do. I think having a wellness policy is better than not having one. Is it being enforced the way that it should be? Probably not. That's why, you know, Chris Benoit got away with, you know, testing as high for testosterone as he did. And, you know, and I'm not going to get into all the issues with that. You know, Benoit obviously used steroids for many years and needed to take testosterone to, you know, supplement the levels that he was not naturally producing. The thing about Benoit, though, was that his levels of testosterone were so out of whack. The fact that nobody picked up on that is a mark on the wellness policy. And I think the change WWE made last week, thanks to Matt Hardy, with banning somas and muscle relaxers, that is a huge development. Now, we'll see whether or not they enforce it like they said they will, but that's a big change. And a change I probably would have made, quite frankly. But the one thing I will say about the wellness policy that I think may be a little bit of an added deterrent, it's not going to deter everybody, but I would make all future test failures public, regardless of whether or not you are a first offender. I think the policy they have in place now is the second time or the third time or whatever they out you on the website. I would say the first time. If you fail a test and you have no good excuse why you failed, if it is not to be disputed, or a second test comes back positive or what have you, if you fail the first time, first offender or not, you're going to be outed. People are going to know your name and that you failed, and also announce what drug they failed for. That is something I don't believe WWE does now. They do that in mixed martial arts. They do that with UFC. They do not do that with WWE. When you fail, I do not believe they tell people what you failed for. So my change would be announce their names, regardless of their past history, once they fail the first time, and mention what they fail for. If it's a hardcore drug, like a street drug like coke, or heroin, or marijuana, announce it. If it's a painkiller like OxyContin or Vicodin, announce it. If it's a muscle relaxer like Soma, announce it. That's the big change that I would make to the wellness policy. Hall of Fame. WWE Hall of Fame. This, of course, is another popular topic that many of you have written in about. A couple of changes. First of all, I don't get the sense that WWE, even though they've talked about it before, is actively looking into having a physical Hall of Fame built, which I think is a mistake. And again, it's not going to be free. These things cost money, and you got to spend your money wisely. However, if you look at the bottom line, WWE does have the money for something like this, and I think that they would make some of that money back fairly quickly. The only question is, where do you construct a Hall of Fame? Obviously, it would make sense to do it at a tourist destination. So Florida comes to mind, ironically, Orlando, where TNA tapes at Universal Studios. That might be one place. People go to Disney World, and they could stop by the WWE Hall of Fame. New York City, to me, probably makes the most sense. I mean, rent in Times Square is not cheap. That's part of the reason why WWF New York is no more. But New York City would seem to be a prime candidate for a Hall of Fame. Of course, you always have the option to do it as part of Titan Tower, to build like a wing in some part of the building or an addendum to the building in Stamford. But let's be honest here. I mean, how many people are going to drive out to Stamford, frickin' Connecticut, to go to the Hall of Fame? Not too many people. So I'm thinking of, again, a place like a New York or an Orlando, you know, L.A., even maybe Vegas. I mean, those places are what would make sense. Because you already have an influx of people, and you know, people can make a trip out of it. They can make a vacation out of it. Oh, we'll go to Vegas for the weekend or for the week, and we'll visit the Hall of Fame while we're there. You can have your store where you can sell merchandise and shit, but there has to be a physical Hall of Fame. I mean, again, right now it's all in Vince McMahon's mind. It's on the website, but you got to have a place where people can go. They have it for the NBA, they have it for the NFL and the NHL. They should have it for WWE as well. Now, the voting process. Right now, essentially, the Hall of Fame is Vince McMahon's call. People do make suggestions to Vince McMahon. Jim Ross has been crowing for years about how they should put Danny Hodge in the Hall of Fame, and of course they never do. And part of the problem with Danny Hodge is they don't really have any footage on him, unfortunately. But essentially, Vince makes all the decisions at the end of the day. And if he's on bad terms with somebody, take Randy Savage, for example, even if that person deserves to go in, they probably aren't going to go in. So obviously, like I said at the beginning here, Vince is dead. He's gone. And the Solo Monster is in charge. And what I would do, first of all, I would cap the number of inductees each year. I get where they would think that three or four is too few, but typically they'll put seven or eight people in the Hall of Fame. I don't know how many they put in last year, but I know they put as many as eight people in at once. That is ridiculous, and it should be no surprise they're running out of names to put in there. I would cap that number at a maximum of six. So that's to say that you don't have to put six people in every year, but at most, you cannot put more than six people in the Hall of Fame in a given year. You could put any, you could put one, you could put three, you could put five. I would not put more than six. That's the cap that I would set on that. Now, what I would do is I would want to welcome wrestler input into the Hall of Fame voting process. I don't think they have anything like that right now. So what I would do, for example, is I would get in a room of people, myself and my top comrades, for lack of a better term, let's say you guys. And we get together, and I'll draft a list of 10 to 20 names of guys who are not in the Hall of Fame, but who are contenders, potential candidates for the Hall of Fame. And what I would do is I would put together a survey. I would put those 10, 15, 20 names in a list with a yes or a no checkmark column. And I would distribute that to the wrestlers backstage. I would give them the opportunity to vote who they want to see in the Hall of Fame. Now, it's not going to be a formal voting process where, okay, we'll tally it up and whatever the final number is, that's who goes in. Ultimately, the decision would be made by us, by me. But I would want to welcome input from other people in there, and it would weigh very heavily in my decision-making. So draft a survey, circulate it, have people vote who they would like to see in there, and they return it to management. And then at that point, we vote on who should go into the Hall of Fame. I think that is a better process to have. It's more inviting. You're welcoming other people's opinions, which probably makes them feel good about themselves. It's just a good thing to be doing all around. The other thing is the Hall of Fame has been airing on TV on USA the last couple of years. It's actually being taped the same night that it airs. In fact, sometimes when they're still on the air, when the Hall of Fame itself is still happening, they're first going on the air with the live TV special. And unfortunately, what that usually results in is the speeches being butchered because you only have an hour. So the TV special is going to be butchered and edited no matter what. If an hour is all that USA is willing to give, there's nothing I can do to change that. However, there is one very big change that I can make, and I cannot understand why Vince McMahon has not done this. Jim Ross has been suggesting this for years. Why can you not tape the Hall of Fame? Have the Hall of Fame ceremony on Friday night before WrestleMania instead of Saturday night. I can't tell you how disrespectful I think it is to think that last year, for example, you had Terry Funk and Dory Funk Jr., the Funk brothers, who have so much history in the wrestling business between the two of them, it's unreal. And to think that you gave them 5 minutes, that everybody has 5 minutes, and think about this, you had the Funks up there together, which means Terry Funk by himself had 2.5 minutes. To talk about his career in professional wrestling. That is an insult. Steve Austin went up there. He may have ended up talking a little more than 5 minutes, but he said himself that there's shit he left out, there's stories he left out because he knew he was on limited time. Steve Austin and Ric Flair, these are guys that should not be waved off because there's not enough time. Now, if you have the Hall of Fame on Friday night, you can let these guys talk as long as they want. And you have an entire day to edit the show down to an hour to air on TV. And you're not forcing these legends to have only 5 minutes to talk about a career's worth of stories and accomplishments. It's an insult. Tape the Hall of Fame on Friday instead of Saturday. I don't see what the big deal is. And just for shits and giggles, as far as who I would put in the Hall of Fame next year, excuse me, Randy Savage is a no-brainer. I don't know what his beef is with Vince McMahon or vice versa, but I would certainly work out something with him to put him in the Hall of Fame. Bob Backlund, I think, deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, former two-time WWE champion. I said earlier that if Sting were willing to come in, he would certainly be deserving of a Hall of Fame induction. Sting should certainly go in. Jake Roberts is another name. The Road Warrior should already be in there. Those are the names I would put in. As far as a manager, I would cap it at 6. I know I'm already at 7 here, but Percy Pringle, or Paul Bear, as many of you know him as, is another manager, I think, much like Bobby Heenan and Jimmy Hart, who definitely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. So that's how I would handle that situation there. Okay, so a couple of other quick thoughts here before we wrap it up. Kind of important miscellaneous items, if I were in charge of WWE. What are my I've been asked this before. What are my thoughts on an off-season? Would I have an off-season if I were in charge of WWE? I would not have an off-season. I've thought about this, and it's just not feasible, I don't think, to take 2 months off or 3 months off. I mean, if you were going to do it, the best time would be right after WrestleMania or right after SummerSlam because you've got football season starting. And you know your ratings are going to take a hit at the beginning of football season anyway, so why not take a month or two off? So if I were doing it, that would be when. But I don't know that an off-season is feasible. Again, you have a contract with USA Network or with Sci-Fi or whatever. You have advertisers. You can't just say, you know what, we're taking the product off the air for the next 30 days or 60 days. You can't do that. You know, I'm trying to be as realistic as possible with this, and it's just not doable. But Jim Ross had this to say to an emailer in a recent blog on his website, quote, "I do not believe that pro wrestling will ever become seasonal because of the massive TV rights fee deals that require first-run programming on a weekly basis. However, I do see how talents could be rotated in a structured way to allow them more downtime to rest and recover. I think structured sabbaticals are attainable, but I didn't say that it would be an easy plan to accomplish, especially in the outset." I agree with him 100%. You know, I'd have to sit down with a group of people and really map out how this would work. But it's a lot easier when you have and consider this. Again, I said at the beginning that, you know, if TNA were dead or dying and I could raid talent from TNA and I could sign some guys from Ring of Honor, all of a sudden I've bolstered my roster to be perhaps the biggest, most talented roster in the history of the business. You have plenty of guys to go around. That just makes it easier to rotate guys on structured sabbaticals, to say, you know what, Undertaker, you need some more time off. And guess what? Your time is now. You're going to be off for the next 6 weeks. Take a break. Or however you want to do it. And you can have a couple of guys do that at once. You're not going to have 5 main eventers take sabbaticals at the same time, but you structure it in such a way where it's manageable. And you're telling people, look, you're going to take time off. You're going to get paid, but you're going to take time off. So that's how I would handle that. You know, again, the fact is, to do an off-season, my idea already calls for cutting the number of pay-per-views from 13 to 7, which is going to piss off a lot of wrestlers who are not going to get those pay-per-view bonuses. I don't want to be the person to then turn around and tell these same wrestlers that we're going to have an off-season, so you're going to get an unpaid 6 or 8 week vacation. They're not going to like that too much, I'm willing to bet. So I agree with Jim Ross wholeheartedly. That's how I would handle that situation. Now, I've also been asked a lot about the brand split. Would I keep the brand split in place or not? No. I would unofficially end the brand split. What I mean by that is I don't think they do themselves any favors. They basically handcuff themselves by saying, well, we have a Raw and a SmackDown roster, so this guy can't appear there, even though we know that does happen. I think there should be one singular WWE roster, even if you have a group of guys who do happen to primarily appear only on Raw, and another group of guys who, by and large, will only show up on SmackDown. You see what I'm saying? It's unofficial. It doesn't mean that that's the only show they can appear on, so you're still trying to sort of keep them separate, but they're not really separate anymore. I don't get the idea of handcuffing yourself to say, we have this great feud that we want to do, but we can't do it because this guy's on Raw and this guy's on SmackDown. Bullshit. They all work for the same company, so cut the crap. Title unification. It sounds like WWE is pretty serious about it, and they're talking about unifying the big belt. They're actually talking about unifying all the belts. They've already done that with the tag belt and the women's belt. And we'll see if they actually follow through on their plans. But essentially, I think what you need is this. You need a singular world champion. You need an intercontinental champion. You need tag team champions. You need a women's champion. And I would be open to the idea of introducing one more secondary belt, that being, let's say, a TV title. And I was not for that before. But when I look at the roster that I've constructed for myself, there's so many guys on the roster that you almost have to have another secondary belt. That's the thing. When you have that many people signed to contracts and that many talented guys on the roster, just having the Intercontinental title ain't going to cut it. So I would be open to the idea of a TV belt where, let's just say, it's only defended on TV and it has a, you know, they're 10-minute time limit matches or something like that. I would also, by the way, make it rare that you have a world title defense on a TV show. So you would have a WWE championship match on Raw every now and then, but it would feel special because title matches would be reserved for special occasions. Title matches would be reserved for special shows, for pay-per-views. You're not going to go, you know, Raw's not going to go on the air one night and you're just going to have a WWE title match put together just like that. That means nothing. You know, that's part of the reason belts don't mean shit. That and the fact that you have multiple world champions, all of those things I would put a stop to. And yes, I would get rid of the spinner belt, so stop asking me. It's still a piece of garbage. I would get rid of it. I'd even be in favor of bringing back the old school intercontinental belt and tag belt designs, too, while we're at it. You know, for those of you who are into that design kind of stuff, I just think a lot of the belts now are just fucking god-awful ugly. The other big thing I would do, there needs to be a power ranking system. Now, TNA tried to institute a ranking system. It's a fucking joke. I would have a top 10 rankings system for the World Championship and a top 5 for every other belt in WWE. And I would try to stay as true to those rankings as possible. Now, you can have matches on Raw or SmackDown where the guy who is the number 3 contender has a match with the guy who's the number 6 contender. And if the number 6 contender beats the number 3 contender, he takes his spot. Like, you can do stuff like that. But you really, I would want to stick to the ranking system and honor it as much as possible. And again, it adds an element of sport. It adds an element of realism. It's fun for fans to go on the website and see the rankings chart and know that the rankings are true and the rankings are being acknowledged on TV and they can follow it on their own. So power rankings, you know, top 10 for the world belt, top 5 for everything else, absolutely. The other thing here, a little idea I came up with, and kind of taking a page out of Vince McMahon's playbook, I'm surprised he hasn't done this already. I don't understand why WWE does not host their own Legends conventions every year. You know, they'll have autograph signings every now and then, I guess, with Legends and stuff like that, but you hear about these things like Wrestle Reunion and in New Jersey and this other convention they had in L.A., wrestling conventions where independent wrestlers and old legends of the business come together to sell their shit and to take pictures with fans and do Q&A sessions. It's a fun thing, and I don't understand why WWE doesn't do that on their own. You know, they have a lot of legends under these WWE Legends contracts, and even the ones they don't, I'm sure they could offer them a little bit of a payout to be a part of the event, and they could probably make a shit ton of money off these things. You know, if you take Rowdy Roddy Piper and the Honky Tonk Man and Brutus the Barber Beefcake and Jake the Snake and a couple of Steve Austin or whoever, you know, and you sign them to these conventions, and you know, you rent out a hall and they're signing autographs and they're taking pictures and you can set up a WWE merchandise table or two and you can have Q&A sessions and if for no other reason, I think it's a revenue stream that is not being tapped into. I would do it just to put the other ones out of business. And it would be a shame to do that because those conventions are very well put together and I'm sure they're very nice. But speaking as somebody who would be in charge of WWE, I would want to make money off that myself. And I think with the WWE brand behind it, if you do one or two per year, at least one, if not two annual conventions, I think you can make a killing, and you would put some of these other conventions out of business, which means more dollars come to me and my company. So I think that's a good idea. That's one idea that I would back if I were in charge of WWE. Another thing here, and again, I can't understand why WWE hasn't already done this, but they have done some fantastic DVD documentaries. And, I mean, really, really good stuff. And I cannot understand, maybe they have, although I would imagine that they would have either won or they would have acknowledged the fact that they had done this, but they need to start submitting some of these documentaries to major film festivals, because I think they could win very easily. And if you were to win an award at a film festival for one of these things, it just brings so much more credibility to your company and could sell a shitload more DVDs. They put, you know, the people who put these things together do such a fantastic job. I think it's worth it. I think it's worth it to submit them to film festivals. You know, a couple of other minor things. I mean, you know, WWE Studios, they've made money, like I said before, on every single movie except The Condemned so far. That's where they make their money, is off the DVD releases. So you know what? No more theatrical runs. Don't put Legendary in theaters for 2 weeks and embarrass yourselves. Just make movies. You know, put your guys in the movies to try to get them over, and just put them out on DVD. Make a little bit of coin off of it. I don't see anything wrong with that. The ban that WWE has on the news websites like The Observer and PW Insider and The Torch and SE Scoops, you need to lift that ban. You need to not be afraid. 2002 is when WWE instituted this blanket ban on all the major wrestling websites, where they were not going to allow their talent to do interviews with them anymore. They weren't going to grant interviews. They weren't going to grant comments to them. And they've kept that policy in place ever since. They've really cut themselves off from that part of the wrestling media, for lack of a better term. And I think that they need to soften that stance. And if I were in charge of WWE, I would soften that stance at least a little bit at first. You know, I'm not saying that all the guys that work for my company are free to go out and say and do what they want to, but there has to be some oversight there, because some guys may take things a little too far. But to just cut off all the wrestling websites like that, I think that was a stupid policy when they enacted it 8 years ago, and it's still a stupid policy today. The blood ban, again, really stupid. I will say this. I will admire the fact that they don't have guys blading themselves and cutting their foreheads anymore. I mean, if you asked me to do that, I don't know that I would want to do that, quite frankly. But there is a time and a place to have blood. To think that they're going to have a Hell in a Cell pay-per-view in 2 weeks that will have no blood is ridiculous. I would lift the blood ban and save blood for special occasions. You don't have to bleed on TV every week like Abyss. You don't need that. But there is a place for it in wrestling. To just stop doing it, or if somebody gets busted open in the middle of a match, especially if it's not that bad, and to kill the momentum of the match, just to close the cut to where the fans turn on you and they turn on the match, it's not a good practice to have, and I would certainly want to reverse that. Last but not least, shifting away from the PG rating to an edgier product, would I be in favor of that? Of course I would be in favor of that. Would I be in favor of a return to the Attitude Era? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The Attitude Era worked in the late 90s. It does not. It will not work. Let's put it that way. It would not work to go back to the way things were. There was a time and a place for that. That era is over. However, that does not mean that you can't have guys go out on TV and drop a couple of salty words every now and then. It doesn't mean that you can't go on TV and have a storyline, let's say, that pushes the boundaries of what one would consider PG. You're not going to put Raw on 1 week with me in charge and see Mae Young giving birth to a hand and Pinata on a pole and you know, all the stupid shit that you would sometimes see back then, which, fun as it may have been, isn't necessarily going to fly in 2010. I would want to wean people off the PG product into a slightly more edgier product. I would want to have the freedom to do that. Understanding that you have companies like Mattel and other sponsors that you have to answer to. There may be some things that they're not happy with. Well, let's test the waters and see what we can get away with. You know, unfortunately, that's the reality of having a publicly traded company with all these sponsors and partnerships that you now have in 2010 that they didn't have 12 years ago. And you have to understand that. You have to respect that. I'm not going to say, fuck you, Mattel, because that would not be a wise business decision. But at the same time, PG is not working. And PG, in my opinion, is not as fun and as enjoyable. And that's why you don't have as many people following the product. I would want to try to bring some of those people back into the product. The only way you're going to do that is to push the envelope a little bit more. And so, yes, I would be in favor of that. And by the way, for the people that have been asking about the John Cena heel turn, it is in the cards. It is being considered, finally, by Vince McMahon and WWE. I still don't know if it'll actually happen, because he sells too much merchandise. But I mentioned this in an email to somebody who sent me an email for the mailbag this week. would I turn John Cena heel? I would, and in fact, the way I would do it, I would go for a John Cena Miz double turn at WrestleMania next year. You know, I mean, Miz, I think Miz could really get over as a babyface, and having Miz cash in Money in the Bank at Mania, but announcing it in advance so as not to make himself look like a pussy, and you have a couple of weeks to promote the match, and then in the match, something happens where the crowd begins to shift, and perhaps Miz wins the title if Cena is the champion, and Cena goes heel. It's the classic double turn, a la Bret Hart, Steve Austin at WrestleMania 13. I think something like that could really work. So that I just wanted to throw that in there because I'm not doing a mailbag this week. We've gone way over time this week, but I just wanted to address that question here. So anyway, whew, that was long. I apologize for that, but there was a lot to get to, and there's probably still some things I'm leaving out. But that, overall, is my WWE business plan. If I were in charge of WWE, it wouldn't happen overnight, but over time, over the course of 6 months or a year, these are the changes. These are the kinds of changes that I think need to be made. You know, some of them are a gamble. Sometimes you got to take a risk. WWE is fortunate enough to still be making so much money, they could afford to take a couple of risks and pump some more money into their developmental system and make some of these changes to pay-per-views and TV. Again, if you're cutting pay-per-views from 13 to 7, you're going to lose money at first, but I think long-term, these pay-per-views are going to mean more. More people are going to buy them, and you're going to end up making more money in the long run. So you got to take a look at the bigger picture here, and that's kind of what I tried to do. I hope you agree with a lot of what I said. I'm sure some of you won't. If you have your own ideas, your thoughts on what I've talked about here, email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/solomonster. And on Facebook, friend me on there, facebook.com/thesolomonster. We're always having fun on Facebook, so why don't you join in there as well. So we're 2 hours into this bad boy here. Don't get used to this. I promise you, if you're a new listener, I promise it is not 2 hours every week. This was a special edition of the Sound Off. I probably should have just cut it up into two parts, but whatever. What the hell. That was fun. That was my WWE plan. I'm not planning on doing one for TNA. I just can't stomach. I can't bring myself to do that. But again, email me your thoughts and your comments. I always appreciate that. And next week, episode 128, Things I Promise, will be back to normal. a much shorter edition of The Sound Off next week. So until next time, be well, stay safe, and we'll see you right back here then. Take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster sounds off on SEScoops.com.